chase those.
Shades of my skin, only add color to my tears. Oh, that splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dream never came true. Oh, is it because I'm black, huh? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Holding me back, I wonder, is it because I'm black? Oh.
Uhuru! Welcome to Reparations in Action, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee, here on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. That was Syl Johnson you just heard, famous blues artist who recorded in Chicago for some time during the 60s with Is It Because I'm Black? I would just like to first thank the African People's Socialist Party for establishing this organization and this hour on Uhuru Radio that gives white people the opportunity to organize and voice their solidarity with the liberation struggle of African people and all colonized people around the world. I am Kristen Gordon, a member of Uhuru Solidarity Movement living in Chicago, and the show today is going to focus on police brutality right here in Chicago, with special emphasis on John Burge, an infamous former police officer that was accused of overseeing the torture of an estimated 200 African and Latino men as a way to coerce confessions to serious crimes that often landed these men in prison for 20 years or more of their life. The second half of the show will be focused on the life and murder of Black Panther Fred Hampton, who was murdered by Chicago police on December 4, 1969, and yesterday was the 41st anniversary of his murder. For John Burge, the accusations of police torture date back 40 years. For nearly two decades, beginning in 1971, Burge was at the epicenter of what has been described as the systematic torture of hundreds of Black men. There are around 110 documented cases of victims being subjected to abuse, including having guns forced into their mouths, suffocation with bags placed over their heads, and electric shocks inflicted to their genitals by a cattle prod. Burge was eventually fired in 1993 for shocking and burning Andrew Wilson during his 1982 interrogation for the murders of two Chicago police officers. Burge was fired, but he evaded prosecution in the 80s because Mayor Daley chose not to prosecute him, and instead continued to use him as a key witness in the prosecution of Andrew Wilson. During the case of Madison Hobley, who was sentenced to death for arson in 1985, in which it was found Madison's confession had been obtained through torture conducted by John Burge and his police, then-Governor of Illinois George Ryan pardoned Hobley and completely emptied death row and declared a moratorium on executions in Illinois in 2000. John Burge this past June was convicted of two counts of obstruction of justice and one count of perjury for denying in a civil lawsuit that he and other detectives had tortured anyone. Burge's trial lasted for 5 weeks, during which time five former torture victims testified about how they had signed false confessions after being suffocated, electrically shocked, beaten, and threatened with guns. But although he was supposed to be sentenced on November 5th, the court has delayed Burge's sentencing to January 20th. He continues to walk free in the meantime. I want to emphasize that he was not convicted of torture, just of lying about the torture. Burge was never charged with torture. A 4-year investigation by a specially appointed Cook County State's Attorney concluded in 2006 that there was evidence that Burge committed torture, but that the statute of limitations had expired, making it impossible to charge him. Local and international civil rights groups savaged the report as a whitewash, saying it was just another example of how prosecutors and police turned a blind eye to Burge's misconduct. I want to play a clip from Democracy Now! That was broadcasted shortly after Burge's conviction in June and includes statements from released victims Mark Clements, Darrell Cannon, and David Bates, three torture victims of Burge, and also an interview with Flint Taylor, attorney at the People's Law Office in Chicago, who defends many of John Burge's victims. Flint Taylor also goes into the details of how Burge, in cohorts with Mayor Daley, evaded being prosecuted for the torture, and also the current push for making police torture a federal crime, so that no statute of limitations could be placed on cases of police torture ever.
Decades after torture allegations were first leveled against the former Chicago police commander John Burge, a federal jury has found him guilty of lying about torturing prisoners into making confessions. Burge has long been accused of overseeing the systematic torture of more than 100 African-American men. The police department fired him in 1993 for mistreatment of a suspect, but did not press charges. More than a decade later, Cook County prosecutors looked into the torture allegations and found that although there was evidence to show torture had occurred, the statute of limitations had expired. 2 years ago, federal prosecutors finally brought charges against Burge, not for torture, but for lying about it. On Monday afternoon, after a 5-week trial, John Burge was found guilty on all counts of perjury and obstruction of justice for lying about the abuse. He could face up to 45 years in prison. Outside the courthouse, the verdict drew a visibly emotional response from one of the men who'd been tortured under Burge, Mark Clements.
And I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone, but it's out.
This was Mark Clements' response when reporters asked him how he felt.
Relieved that finally at least one of these people are now going to finally feel the pain. My daughter is 29 years old. I missed all those years with my daughter sitting in them prison cells for a crime I did not commit. I do not feel sorry for John Burge. That's all I have to say.
Mark Clements, one of the dozens of men who were tortured under former Chicago Police Commander John Burge. I'm joined now from Chicago by Flint Taylor, an attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, has represented many of the torture victims. Welcome to Democracy Now! Your response to the guilty verdict, Flint Taylor.
It was a wonderful victory for the African-American community and all people here in Chicago who have fought so long and so hard for justice. This fight, as you've mentioned, has gone on for decades. It's a human rights victory that should be understood across the entire country. Because here in Chicago, we've now done something after 30 years of struggle that has not happened anywhere else. And that is, we have a conviction of a torturer, a United States torturer. And that is what the lesson needs to be taken by the Obama administration, who seems so leery to prosecute people like Cheney and people under his command for torture abroad by the U.S. Now we have an example. And actually, it was a Republican prosecutor who did this. So I think that we all across this country should take a lesson from Chicago. But we're also saying, and this struggle has to continue, because there are many men under the command of John Burge who are being investigated, who need to be indicted. There are men behind prison bars still who are there because of the torture, by tortured confessions. We need to have a federal statute that says that torture is a crime akin to other human rights violations that has no statute of limitations, so future Burges cannot end up being prosecuted only for perjury and not for the torture that happened. And we need to have full compensation by the city for the men, many of whom have never had or cannot have lawsuits, men who came forward and are the true heroes of this peace and this prosecution, the men who testified against Burge and who were ripped from pillar to post by his lawyer in a very racist way and presented to this jury that it was okay to torture them. It's okay to torture poor black men who are charged with crimes who may have been in street gangs. And this jury, which only had one African-American on it, spoke loudly and said, no, it's not right to torture. Doesn't matter if you're poor and black and a criminal. And I think the message is it doesn't matter if you're a terrorist either or an alleged terrorist, that we cannot countenance torture in this country or by this country. And until all people who torture and all those people who are responsible for torturing are brought to justice, the conscience of Chicago and the conscience of this country cannot be cleansed.
Last month, just as the trial was beginning, I spoke to Daryl Cannon, one of the dozens of men to come forward with allegations of abuse at the hands of the Chicago police. He says police tortured him in 1983. and forced him to confess to a murder he didn't commit. He spent more than 20 years in prison, but after a hearing on his tortured confession, prosecutors dismissed his case in 2004. Now he's suing Chicago for wrongful conviction. In this clip, he's describing the torture he was subjected to by the Chicago police under John Birch's command.
By them not being successful in getting what they wanted out of me, they did a third treatment, which was they put me in the back seat of a detective car. They unhandcuffed my cuffs from behind, put them in front. John Burns had a gun to my head and told me, don't move, when they redid the handcuffs. They put me sideways in the back seat of a detective car and made me lay down across the seat. They pulled my pants and my shorts down, and that's when Burns took an electric caliper, turned it on, and proceeded to shock me on my testicles. They did this what seems like forever with me, but it wasn't that long. At one point, I was able to kick the caliper out of the detective's hands, and that knocked the batteries out. He got the batteries, put them back in. One of them tried to take his feet and put it on top of one of my feet. The other one did the same thing to stop me from kicking. And then this is when they started using the electric caliper on me again while telling me that they knew that I wasn't the one they wanted, but I had the information that could lead them to the other person that they wanted. They continued to do this until finally I agreed to tell them anything they wanted to hear. Anything. It didn't matter to me. You know, if they said, did your mother do it? Yes, yes, yes. Because the diabolical treatment that I received was such that I had never in my life experienced anything like this. I didn't even know anything like this here existed in the United States.
I also want to turn to an interview I did in 2006 with David Bates, who says he was tortured by men under Burge's command. This is how he described what happened to him.
I believe it was October 28th or 29th, 1983, when a few officers knocked on my mom's door and announced that they were police officers and let my mom know that I'll be taken away and that I'll be coming home shortly. There was supposed to be some questions regarding the case. Of course, I got to the police station. I was questioned. I let the officers or detectives know that I had nothing to do with the case. I knew nothing. This went on for 2 days. At that time, it was five sessions of torture, starting with two slaps and kicks and threats. It was two particular sessions of torture that was very devastating, which a plastic bag was placed over my head. I was punched and kicked, and I tell you, when you talk about torture, you're talking about individuals who, most part, were young, had few brushes with the law, but never in a million years thought that they would have a plastic bag placed over their head. More importantly, the torture has never been resolved. No one has ever owned up to the torture. So we have hundreds of individuals who have psychologically been warped, been destroyed. There's never been any clinical resolution to the torture. No one has owned up to it.
That was Daryl Cannon. We talked to him in 2006. Flint Taylor, how is it possible that we're talking perjury here and not actual torture?
Well, it goes right back to the mayor of the city of Chicago, Richard Daley, back in the early 80s when this torture first came to light and a doctor from the jail brought definitive evidence to the chief of police, who then brought it to Daley, who was the chief prosecutor at that time. Daley chose not to prosecute Burge, but rather continued to use Burge as a key witness in the prosecution of the person who was tortured. That went on for 6 or 8 years after that, while Daley was the prosecutor, and Daryl Cannon's case arose during that time, David Bates's case arose during that time, and scores of others were tortured. If those men Those men never would have been tortured if Daley had acted back in 1982 and prosecuted Burge for torture rather than for obstruction of justice. Since he did not do that, and since the Justice Department under Reagan, first Reagan, later Bush 1, then Clinton, and then Bush 2, none of those Justice Departments listened to the movement's pleas to prosecute Burge for torture when the statute had not run. So the statute was gone by the time that Fitzgerald, the prosecutor who did indict him, after decades of struggle and decades of fighting by the people that were fighting for justice, did indict him. All that was left was his lying in lawsuits that we had brought, that he had lied about torturing people, that he obstructed justice by lying about torturing people. That's all he could be charged with now. That's why we need a federal statute that not only makes police torture a federal crime, but says no statute of limitations. If you cover it up, you can be prosecuted 10, 20, 30 years later. Because these are crimes against humanity. This is like the prosecutions in the South of the Klansmen who blew up the church and killed the little children. No matter how long it takes, how many decades, you have to prosecute these people for what they did. And David Bates and Daryl Cannon's case, they were both prosecuted by John Byrne and Peter Dignan, the two right-hand men of Burge. They have to be prosecuted as well. There's an open investigation, and we're now calling for them to be indicted and to be prosecuted. And the entire political structure here is in question. And the mayor is still is silent at this point. But the money that the city of Chicago has paid has to be stopped for defending Burge and his men.
You're talking Mayor Daley.
Of course. The city has paid and still pays tens of millions of dollars for pensions for these men. They've paid over $10 million to defend the cases in civil courts. They're still paying for defense of Burge in the civil courts. The Fraternal Order of Police has paid millions of dollars to defend Burge in the criminal cases. So the city is still on the wrong side of this issue after all these years. And one man who testified, Melvin Jones, is homeless. He never has gotten a nickel over all these years, yet he's come forward and testified. The city has to make these people whole. Just because they don't have a lawsuit that they can bring, there has to be compensation. There has to be treatment offered to these men. There are over 110 men who have been tortured. That's been documented. So this jury only heard from a few of them. There are many others that are still behind bars. All of these issues remain unresolved in the city. And so the conscience of this city and justice in the city cannot be obtained until all of these issues are dealt with. And that's why people rejoice in this verdict, but that we know that how many more years or decades, hopefully not, however much longer it takes, we have to get full justice in these cases and make sure that this kind of thing cannot and does not happen again.
Flint Taylor, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Flint Taylor, the attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago.
Pretty much as soon as Mark Clements was released in August 2009 after 28 years in prison from a tortured confession to arson when he was 16, he began working and building in Chicago to raise awareness about the many other victims of John Burge who have yet to be exonerated. This is a clip from the Take a Stand Against Torture rally that occurred at the Daley Plaza on the first day of Burge's trial. Mark Clements led the rally, and he demanded that Mayor Richard Daley ask Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez to grant new hearings for 20 tortured victims still incarcerated. The city of Chicago has spent over $10 million in taxpayer dollars paying for Burge's defense, even after the Police Department Review Board ruled that he was guilty of using torture. Mark Clements is founder of the Jail John Burge Committee and is the executive director of the Campaign to End the Death Penalty.
The mayor on the fifth floor, I speak loud and clear. My name is Mark Clements, and I respectfully ask you right now to go over to Anita Alvarez and to grant these hearings. You have the legal jurisdiction to do it. If you do not do it, I will state again to resign. Stanley Howard, he was exonerated. He still sits in prison. Why is Stanley Howard being denied of clemency by the governor of this state?
Right.
This stuff must come to an end.
Woo!
I want Chicago today to feel my pain.
Yeah.
Upstairs, as the mayor, will he go to Anita Alvarez and ask her to grant hearings in the 19 men cases? I'm not going to bat back. If we have to be back here next month, I will mobilize it to be even noisier. What I'm saying is that the mayor of the city of Chicago is responsible for 85% of these convictions. He has a legal ethic because he prosecuted those men. And having that legal ethic, he has a right to ask Anita Alvarez to undo his wrongs.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you.
Many of Burge's victims, including Stanley Howard, Madison Hobley, Aaron Patterson, Ronald Kitchen, Leroy Orange, Leonard Kidd, Andrew Maxwell, Frank Bounds, Reginald Mahaffey, and Jeffrey Mahaffey, were sentenced to death due to tortured confessions. Collectively, these men are known as the Death Row 10. Four of the Death Row 10, Howard, Hobley, Orange, and Patterson, were pardoned by former Governor George Ryan in 2003, which I mentioned earlier, yet Howard remains in Dixon Correctional Center. Bounds died under medical conditions, and Patterson is serving time in federal prison, even though he was pardoned. Burge's sentencing hearing has been postponed until January 20th, and it will be at 219 South Dearborn Street. He could face up to 45 years behind bars, but we understand in the Huru Solidarity Movement that that still will not be justice. I think it's also important to mention that the torture techniques that Burge used, or oversaw the use of, were interrogation techniques that he learned to use against the Vietnamese people when he served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. Burge became a police officer in 1970, very shortly after being honorably discharged from the Army not 6 months before. I want to play a clip of testimony given by Joy Mogul on police brutality and the John Burge torture cases. Joy Mogul is the attorney to several Chicago police torture victims. This testimony was given on May 23, 2008, to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Racism on his visit to Chicago to discuss racial discrimination practices in the city. Following Joy Mogul's testimony are remarks by Anthony Holmes. Holmes was tortured by John Burge in 1973.
With respect to the Chicago police torture cases, I'd like to put them into context. There were over 100 African-American men who were tortured by John Burge and other white detectives under his command. And if we use the word torture, we do not use it flippantly. Men were electrically shocked with cattle rods and electric shock box. Other men were suffocated with plastic bags. Many were beaten about their bodies, and they were deprived of food, water, and bathroom facilities for hours and days on end. And not only did these men suffer this grueling physical torment, but they were subjected to racial epithets and racial slurs throughout their interrogations. I feel very uncomfortable using the words that were used by these detectives, but I feel I need to do so because it gets to the heart of the racism of these cases. So many of the victims were called nigger. The electric shock box that was used by John Burge and others was called the nigger box. One African-American victim was threatened to be hung like other African-Americans, an obvious reference to lynchings. And Burge was known for taunting his victims after torturing them, saying, if you complain about this, who's going to believe you, a cop or a nigger like you? It's clear that this pattern and practice of racist torture violates Article 1, Article 2, and Article 5B of the Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Racial Discrimination. There's no doubt about it. Despite the wealth of evidence, numerous judicial decisions, and over 8 investigations that have confirmed that this torture took place and that members of the chain of command knew about it and failed to stop it. Not a single officer has been prosecuted for their crimes or their international human rights violations. They enjoy impunity with respect to their crimes. Meanwhile, the victims continue to suffer. There are at least 25 African-American men who remain behind bars, languishing in prison as a result of their wrongful convictions, which were based in whole or in part on their tortured confessions. Other victims have finished their sentences. However, they are now out, but they still suffer the psychological damage of the torture and their wrongful convictions, and they have no access to any compensation or psychological services. With respect to these torture cases, I've provided you further information. There's 3 things that we think are necessary that the U.S. government and local authorities on behalf of the U.S. government must do in order to be in compliance with the Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The U.S. Attorney's Office now has announced it is prosecuting its investigating officers for crimes of perjury and obstruction of justice because they lied about their acts of torture. There must be a prosecution. We've had enough investigations. Burge and others must be prosecuted for their crimes. Is that these 25 African-American men who remain behind bars, they are entitled to new hearings. Under Article 15 of the Convention Against Torture, it is illegal to use torture confessions against people in their criminal cases. That's what was done here. They should be having an opportunity to present evidence to demonstrate they were tortured, and if that is found, they should be given new hearings. Finally, with respect to many of the torture victims, because the torture occurred in the 70s and 80s and they were wrongfully convicted, it's too late for them to now sue. The statute of limitations is now expired. There's no way for them to get any financial compensation. And Anthony Holmes here, one of the torture victims, that's his exact position that he's in today. It's incumbent on the city of Chicago and the county of Cook to come up with reparations, to come up with a fund to provide financial compensation for these victims in compliance with Article 6 of the Convention. Thank you. Thank you, Holmes. He was tortured by John Burge in 1973.
Recommendation, 1 minute, please. We're short on time, very short.
Y'all need to do is, you ain't. I sent y'all a ticket. I ain't from a deposition. The law firm gave y'all. In the process of that, since that ticket was showed, I don't know if you're going to rule on that, but anyway, I'm glad y'all came. At least that show you see the face not behind the ticket. But the bottom line is, until y'all do something, make the United States, Illinois, all of them, and not only people here, but it's all in the States. This torture going on. Ain't nobody said nothing. When it happened to me, didn't nobody believe me. They didn't want to believe me. And they threatened me when I went to the county jail and told them I had been tortured. So what I'm saying is, help us help ourselves. We ain't asking for no handouts, we ain't asking for nothing. All we want is to get our rights back. So we can out here. Since I've been struggling, but I ain't got no problem struggling. I've been struggling all my life. You know, I wasn't a good guy, but I wasn't a bad guy. I didn't deserve what happened to me, nor did anybody else that it happened to. But the bottom line is, the whole scenario, you cannot accept this and let this keep going like this. Because sooner or later, what's going to happen is, people going to rebel. And when once they rebel, you're going to tear everything else around. And then they're going to say, why y'all do this? Why we do it? Because you just stepped on us. You didn't give us no rights. You didn't give us nothing. You don't understand the pain we're going through. You're talking about kids getting killed every day, you're talking about all this here. When you close down all the schools, you close down the playgrounds. I remember when I was coming, we made playgrounds, people were hitting playgrounds in every neighborhood.
That's right.
We made wrestling, basketball, baseball, all of that. Right. We ain't got none of that now. Because they come on, we show all the money. But they'll take it and put it somewhere else.
That's right.
But you get these fake police, and get them jobs and get them money to take to oversee us. And what the bottom line is, we hurt them because they hurt us. Ain't no criminal justice in this place.
Ain't no justice.
You know what I'm saying? That's why we suffer. And the more we suffer, the worse we can get.
As white people, we need to recognize that incidents surrounding John Burge are not an anomaly. This is not the case of just one bad cop. The police are agents of this state and serve to maintain the status quo and keep African people and other oppressed people under colonial control. This serves the interests of the ruling class, keeping them at the top and the majority at the bottom. Police torture and police murders occur every day in cities around the country. And there's a long history of police violence right here in Chicago. Yesterday, December 4th, was the 41st anniversary of the murder of Fred Hampton, the brilliant, beloved young leader of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, who was only 21 years old when he was murdered by the Chicago Police Department, along with the FBI and other federal secret police forces. The Uhuru Solidarity Movement recognizes that the only reason that people like John Burge and others who carry out this brutal war against the African community here in Chicago and all around the U.S. can function is because the African Revolution of the 1960s was crushed by the U.S. government COINTELPRO program. COINTELPRO was the U.S. government counterinsurgency program that specifically targeted the African Revolution of the 60s. It was responsible for the assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Bobby Hutton, and so many others. A counterinsurgency is the U.S. government's war against an oppressed people that is rising up to struggle for freedom and liberation. The U.S. is waging a counterinsurgency against the people of Afghanistan right now. After the Black Revolution was destroyed, the U.S. government imposed a counterinsurgency against the entire African population with the imposition of the illegal drug economy in the African community and the use of designer laws such as three strikes that are responsible for locking up a huge percentage of the African community today. This was to make sure that the community would not rise up again against their conditions. Fred Hampton, who grew up in Chicago, was immediately attracted to the Black Panthers' approach of black self-determination and black consciousness. Hampton's organizing skills, substantial oratorical gifts, and personal charisma allowed him to rise quickly in the Panthers. Hampton was responsible for brokering a non-aggressive pact between the Chicago's most powerful street gangs, emphasizing that racial and ethnic conflict between gangs would only keep its members entrenched in poverty. Hampton strove to forge a class-conscious, multiracial alliance between the Black Panthers, the Students for a Democratic Society, the Blackstone Rangers, the National Young Lords in Chicago, the Young Patriots, the Brown Berets, and the Red Guard Party. Hampton quickly became the leader of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panthers. He organized weekly rallies, worked closely with the Panthers' local People's Clinic, taught political education classes every morning at 6 a.m., and launched a project for community supervision of the police. Hampton was also instrumental in the Panthers' free breakfast program. As the Panther leadership across the country began to be decimated by the impact of COINTELPRO, Hampton's prominence in the national hierarchy increased rapidly and dramatically. Eventually, Hampton was in line to be appointed to the party's central committee's chief of staff. He would have achieved this position had it not been for his death on the morning of December 4th, 1969. Here are some clips from the documentary, The Murder of Fred Hampton, that shows just how incredible a leader Fred Hampton was.
So we always say to the Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the people. A lot of people don't understand the Black Panther Party's relationship with white mother country radicals. A lot of people don't even understand that words that they'll refuse a lot. But what we're saying is that there are white people in the mother country that are for the same types of things that we are for stimulating revolution in the mother country. And we said that we work with anybody and form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. And we're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people. We don't think you fight fire with fire, bitch. We think you fight fire with water, bitch. We're going to fight racism, not with racism, but we're going to fight with solidarity. We said we're not going to fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we're going to fight it with socialism. We stood up and said we're not going to fight reactionary pigs and reactionary state attorneys like this and reactionary state attorneys like Hanrahan with any other reactions on our part. We're going to fight their reaction with all of us people to get together and have an international
imagine the Fulton Revolution.
Black people need some peace. White people need some peace. And we are going to have to fight. We're going to have to struggle. We're going to have to struggle relentlessly to bring about some peace, because the people that we're asking for peace, they're a bunch of megalomaniac warmongers, and they don't even understand what peace means. And we've got to fight them. We've got to struggle with them to make them understand what peace means. Bobby Seale is going through all types of physical and mental torture. But that's all right, because we said even before this happened, and we're going to say it after this, and after I'm locked up, and after everybody's locked up, that you can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution. Right. You might run a liberator like Harris Cleaver out the country, but you can't run liberation out the country. You might murder a freedom fighter like Bobby Hutton, but you can't murder freedom fighting. And if you do, you come up with answers that don't answer, explanations that don't explain. You come up with conclusions that don't conclude. And you come up with people that you thought should be acting like pigs, that's acting like people and moving on pigs. And that's what we've got to do. So we're going to see about Bobby, regardless of what these people think we should do. Because school is not important and work is not important. Nothing's more important than stopping fascism, because fascism will stop us all.
See, I got the thing is with me, you dig, I need to know some more about it. I wish you had some more literature about the educational thing here. Because, you dig, as far as we're concerned in the struggle, the way we look at struggle is that this depends on the educational thing, you dig. Let me give you an example. Yomo Kenyatta formed an excellent revolution with no education. And on the day of the end thing, Yomo told the motherfucker, I said, well, you've been educated to hate the enemy, but I'm your brother. I help you lead the revolution. Now I'm more oppression. Another example, Papa Doc in Haiti. Papa Doc in Haiti hated everything white. Man, you couldn't put this white paper in front of Papa Doc's face. But he moved all the white people out, and he took over and be oppressed when he did, because of no education. And the people that have been educated, they just said that we don't hate the motherfucker white people, we hate the oppressor, whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow. So we got to know your educational program to find out what is going to be in the finale. A lot of people, Yomo Kenyatta is called not a... never a revolutionary, but an ex-revolutionary. So it's Papa Doc. They brought on a successful revolution. That thing in the Mamas was a bitch. Bantu freedom fighters, all that kind of action. What we're saying is, it's the end. But you don't judge Castro now. You can't do it. Nobody in this room could judge whether Castro's going to be a revolutionary or not. You know what I mean? We're talking about things, you know what I mean, with China, the People's Republic, and even at the stage they're in now, talking about even going on further into a communistic state. That's what we're talking about. That was a revolutionary. So we got to understand here the educational program that you have to be able to figure out whether it will go on the right lines, where the people will end up in a situation where they can be able to really control themselves. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, the people that take this local foundation and start stealing money, because they won't be really educated to why it's the people's thing anyway. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, you have neocolonialism instead of colonialism, like you got in Africa now, like you got in Haiti. So what we're talking about is there has to be educational program. That's very important. As a matter of fact, we are so important for us that a person has to go through 6 weeks of our political education before he can consider himself a member of the party, able to even run down ideology for the party. Why? Because if they don't have an education, then they're nowhere. You dig what I'm saying? They're nowhere because they don't even know why they're doing what they're doing. You might get people caught up in an emotionless movement. You understand me? You might get them caught up in because they're poor and they want something. And then if they're not educated, they want more. And before you know it, they'll be capitalists. And before you know it, we'll have Negro imperialists.
You know what we're talking about? We're talking about a beat that can't be stopped by anybody. We're talking about we're going to make some changes in this system. We know they have our pictures, we know they're looking for us, we know they want us, but we're still saying that even though we could be in a sense, as far as this system goes, on the mountaintop, we in the Black Panther Party, because of our dedication and understanding what's in the valley, knowing that the people in the valley, knowing that we originally came from the valley, knowing that our flag is the same flag as the people in the valley, knowing that our enemy is on the mountaintop, our friends are in the valley, we say even though it's nice to be on the mountaintop, we're going back to the valley. I'd be in offices every day. I'd be in the streets propagandizing every day. I'd be working with everybody every day. I'd be teaching that solidarity is the thing. The end of a complete wipeout of imperialism is the thing. So if you're going to be thinking about me, that's what Bobby would be teaching. If you're going to be thinking about us, all we say is we don't, ain't no thing about going nowhere, getting killed. All we want to know is that you're doing what we'd be doing if we were here. And you've got to do that. You can't do it unless you believe that you can do it.
the spirit of liberation. We understand that they want everybody in the party in jail. And we know that if we try to figure out and separate and divide who should go and who shouldn't go, we spend more time doing that than working for the people. So the quick solution, the speedy one, nobody go. Nobody go.
Nobody go.
We all stay right here.
We all stay right here.
With the people.
With the people.
Because we love the people.
Because we love
them. Okay, you can put your hands down now. We say all power to all people.
All
people. And we are going to have to fight. We're going to have to struggle. We're going to have to struggle relentlessly to bring about some peace. Because the people that we're asking for peace, they're a bunch of megalomaniac warmongers, and they don't even understand what peace means. And we've got to fight them. We've got to struggle with them to make them understand what peace means.
While Hampton impressed many of the people with whom he came into contact with as an effective leader and talented communicator, those very qualities marked him as a major threat in the eyes of the FBI. It began keeping close tabs on his activities. FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover was determined to prevent the formation of a cohesive black radical movement in the U.S. Hoover saw the Panthers and radical coalitions like that forged by Hampton in Chicago as a frightening stepping stone toward the creation of just such a revolutionary body that could, in its strength, potentially overthrow the government of the United States. After all, the goal in the formation of COINTELPRO was to prevent the rise of a black messiah who could unify and electrify the militant black movement, and to prevent black radical groups and leaders from gaining respectability by discrediting them to the community. The final goal of COINTELPRO was to prevent the long-range growth of militant black organizations, especially among youth. These are excerpts taken straight from COINTELPRO documents. The FBI opened a file on Hampton in 1967 that over the next 2 years would expand to 12 volumes and over 4,000 pages. A wiretap was placed on Hampton's mother's phone in February 1968. By May of that year, Hampton's name was placed on the Agitator Index, and he would be designated a key militant leader for Bureau reporting purposes. By means of anonymous letters, the FBI sowed distrust and eventually instigated a split between the Panthers and the Blackstone Rangers, a Chicago street gang, with FBI informant William O'Neill instigating an armed clash between the two on April 2, 1969. The Panthers became effectively isolated from their power base in the ghetto, so the FBI went to work to undermine its ties with other radical organizations. O'Neill was instructed to create a rift between the party and the Students for a Democratic Society, whose Chicago headquarters were only blocks away from that of the Panthers. The Bureau released a batch of racist cartoons in the Panthers' name, aimed at alienating white activists and the Students for a Democratic Society. J. Edgar Hoover repeatedly demanded that the COINTELPRO personnel destroy what the Panthers stand for, and eradicate its Serve the People programs. On July 16, 1969, there was an armed confrontation between party members and the Chicago police, which left one member mortally wounded and six others arrested on serious charges. On July 31st, the Chicago police raided the Monroe Street office, smashing typewriters, destroying food and medical supplies for the Panther Health Clinic and Breakfast Program, setting several small fires, and beating and arresting a number of Panthers for obstruction. A similar raid took place on October 31st. During this time, Fred Hampton was quickly moving up the ranks in the Black Panther Party. In November 1969, Hampton traveled to California and met with National Black Panther leadership at UCLA. It was there that they offered him a position on the Central Committee as the Chief of Staff and asked him to serve as the National Spokesman for the Panthers. The FBI, determined to prevent any enhancement of the effectiveness of Panther leadership, decided to set up an arms raid on Hampton's Chicago apartment. It was FBI informant William O'Neill again who provided Chicago police with detailed information of Hampton's apartment, including the location of furniture and the bed in which Hampton and his then-pregnant girlfriend slept. A 14-man team of the SAO, the Special Prosecutions Unit, was organized for a pre-dawn raid armed with a warrant for illegal weapons. And so, at 5 a.m. on December 4, 1969, 14 police officers stormed Hampton's apartment instantly killing Black Panther Mark Clark, who was on security duty, sitting in the front room of the apartment with a shotgun in his lap. He was killed instantly after firing off a single round, which was later determined to be a reflexive action in his death convulsions after being shot by the raiding team. This was the only shot the Panthers fired. Automatic gunfire then converged at the head of the bedroom where Hampton slept, unable to wake up as a result of the barbiturates that William O'Neill had slipped into his drink the night before. Police shot him dead, and then dragged his body into the doorway of the bedroom and left him in a pool of blood. The officers then directed their gunfire towards the remaining Panthers, who were hiding in another bedroom. They were wounded, then beaten and dragged into the street, where they were arrested on charges of aggravated assault and the attempted murder of the officers. They were each out on $100,000 bail. Here's a clip of a Chicago police statement on the morning raid of Fred Hampton's apartment, and then attorney Skip Andrews' response to the police cover-up of the murder.
The immediate, violent, criminal reaction of the occupants in shooting at announced police officers emphasizes the extreme viciousness of the Black Panther Party. So does their refusal to cease firing at the police officers when urged to do so several times.
This is 2337 West Monroe, described by police as a depot for Black Panther Party arms and ammunition. 14 state's attorney's policemen, led by Sergeant Daniel Groth, found out indeed it was a depot for weapons. After a 15-minute gun battle that cost Illinois Black Panther Party Chairman Fred Hampton his life, Sergeant Groth described the raid as 50 minutes of hell and a miracle. A miracle because not one policeman was killed, a miracle because not more policemen were shot. The firing stopped only when the occupants realized their arsenal was no match for the police arsenal, an arsenal that included a .45 caliber submachine gun and two shotguns.
What they didn't understand, what Edward B. Henrahan doesn't understand, and what Richard Jolovec, his chief assistant, didn't understand, and what those police officers who put those two bullets in the skull of his head as he lay asleep didn't understand, and what Richard Nixon and his assistant lackey, Mr. Mitchell, don't understand,
is that you can't kill Chairman Fred.
Right on!
What they didn't understand is that anyone who would try to kill him is and shall ever be an enemy of the people. And that whoever would do that can only be appropriately called not a person, but a pig. What they didn't understand when they did that is that pigs die, but Chairman Fred lives.
Fred Hampton's girlfriend, who was 8 months pregnant, Akua Najeri, also known as Deborah Johnson, was sleeping beside Fred Hampton when the police began pummeling the apartment with gunfire. Panthers yelled at the police to stop shooting because there was a pregnant woman in the room, but this did not deter police at all. She survived the shooting and gave birth to his son, Fred Hampton Jr., 4 weeks later. She describes her last moments with Fred Hampton in this clip.
Someone came into the room, started shaking the chairman, said, Chairman, wake up, the pigs are vamping. Still half asleep, I looked up and I saw bullets coming from it looked like the front of the apartment from the kitchen area. They were, pigs were just shooting. And about this time, I jumped on top of the chair. He looked up. Looked like all the pigs burst at the entrance way to the bedroom area, back bedroom area. The mattress is just going, you could feel the bullets going into it. I just knew we'd be dead, everybody in there. When he looked up, he didn't say a word, and he didn't move, except for moving his head up. He laid his head back down to the side like that. He never said a word, and he never got up out the bed. The person who was in the room, they kept hollering out, stop shooting, stop shooting. We have a pregnant woman or a pregnant sister in here. At that time, I was 8.5 to 9 months pregnant. My baby was to be delivered in 2 weeks. Pigs kept on shooting. So he kept on hollering out. Finally, they stopped. They pushed me and the other brother by the kitchen door and told us to face the wall. Heard a pig say, "He's barely alive, he'll barely make it." I assumed they were talking about Chairman Fred. Then they started shooting the pigs. They started shooting again. I heard a sister scream. They stopped shooting. Pig said, "He's good and dead now." The pigs were running around laughing. They were really happy, you know, talking about Chairman Fred is dead. I never saw Chairman Fred again.
The documentary on Fred Hampton, The Murder of Fred Hampton, began as a film portrait of Hampton and the Illinois Black Panther Party, but halfway through the shoot, Hampton was murdered. This film is an excellent resource for learning about Fred Hampton and the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party and includes footage of the last speeches and appearances of Hampton. Fred Hampton was murdered because the U.S. government knew he had the charisma, the political theory, and the dedication to be at the forefront of a movement that could have ended imperialism and global capitalism. The U.S. government was attempting to silence the voice of the African Revolution, but as Fred Hampton said, "You can kill the revolutionary, but you can't kill the revolution." The Uhuru movement is living proof of that statement, as it is a body of African revolutionaries around the world who are organized and struggle to overthrow a system based on the exploitation of African people and all colonized people. Uhuru Solidarity Movement is an organization of white activists who stand in solidarity with this liberation struggle. To get involved with the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, check out our website at uhurusolidarity.org. If you live in Chicago, the Jail John Birch Coalition is having a protest on Human Rights Day this Friday, December 10th, that is being held by the Jail John Birch Coalition and is calling on the Cook County Special Prosecutor to grant hearings to Birch's victims who are still in prison. These victims are Stanley Rice, Javon Deloney, Graylin Johnson, Eric Kane, and Edward James. Birch's sentencing hearing will be January 20th on 219 South Dearborn Street. The Jail John Birch Committee and Mark A. Clements are also on Facebook, and you can find out more about upcoming events in Chicago on their pages. To get involved in Uhuru Solidarity Movement, a movement which stands in solidarity with the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party, who are bringing about an end to an economic system which subjects the world's non-white peoples to poverty, brutality, and colonial control, you can go to uhurusolidarity.org. There is also an Uhuru Solidarity Movement page on Facebook. The Uhuru Holiday Online Auction ends tomorrow, December 6th at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you haven't checked out the auction yet, you want to do that today. There are hundreds of really unique items, art, jewelry, clothing, perfect gifts for family and friends for the holidays, and all of the proceeds go towards creating economic development and supporting social justice in the African community through the African People's Education and Defense Fund. The website for the online auction is at apedf.org/auction. This is an annual fundraiser for the programs of the African People's Education and Defense Fund. It's a great way to make social justice for the African community part of your holiday season. Again, the website for the auction is apedf.org/auction. The International Conference for White Solidarity with Black Power, being organized by the African People's Solidarity Committee, an organization of the Uhuru Movement, is being held on January 9th through the 11th at the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida. For more information and to register for the conference, you can check out uhurusolidarity.org and click on 2011 Conference in the Events tab. Thank you for listening to Reparations in Action today. Uhuru.
The first bottom over here, and the bottom of a ship.